morning and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Monday, May 5th, we're studying 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 13 to 46. In today's text, Solomon ensures that those who might oppose his reign as king will no longer threaten him. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, Pastor Jeremiah Johnson. Pastor Johnson serves at Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota. Pastor Johnson, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Thanks. Great to be here.
As we get started today, remind us of the context of this part of 1 Kings chapter 2.
Well, if you remember, let's just say Solomon's ascent to the throne was not an easy or a straightforward process. And of course, David had other sons who were all in competition with him. And of course, Adonijah had kind of, set himself up most recently along with a couple of other players to be the king. And then David, he kind of steps in and makes sure that Solomon actually ends up ascending to the throne. And so, but just before this, we have the death of David, and what happens is that David gives him kind of like final instructions. But so we do well to remember a little bit of that about that. First of all, that he exhorts Solomon to basically keep the Lord's commands. And I think it's specifically with regard to, being a king. So yes, generally it talks about keeping his statutes and his commandments and his testimonies and the law of Moses and so on and so forth. But also implicit within all of this is that, David reminds Solomon that he's the Lord's king. He's not his own man. And I think we need to remember all of that as we kind of see a lot of what seem like political machinations in this upcoming chapter. But David does list a couple of issues that still need to be addressed. First of all, there's this character, Joab, who's one of the commanders of his army. And boy, there's a long history about that. We can dive into that a little bit more when we actually talk about his judgment on Joab. But he's a mixed character, to say the least. He also, Barzillai, who actually showed David great kindness. David wants to make sure that his loyalty is honored. And so he tells Solomon, basically, just take care of Barzillai's family, and that's all good. And then there was a strange character by the name of Shimei, and he had cursed David, when David basically was running for his life when Absalom, his son, had made a play on the throne quite successfully and basically made David run for his life. And he basically says, make sure you take care of Shimei. And so it's all, I don't know, maybe as a word of introduction, we were just talking about this beforehand, but it's important that we keep in mind that Solomon is doing these things, yes, to protect the throne. But I don't think he's doing it in kind of like a narcissistic sort of way where he's just paranoid and he's killing everybody around him, just because they pose a threat. Because we'll actually see, he lets people live who maybe he shouldn't have. And so, and he gives mercy and grace to them. And so I think we need to evaluate each and every one of these. This is not just a ruthless consolidation of power. Like I think sometimes it gets misconstrued, but it is shrewd. So let's also not, this is not like a rated G chapter. There's a lot of blood.
That's very true. I think from David's instructions to Solomon, perhaps the very end of verse 4 is key when it comes to understanding this theologically, mm-hmm. where David mm-hmm. instructs him in this matter, so that you will not lack a man on the throne of Israel. Taking that back to the promise that God made to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7, that the Christ would come through the line of David and reign over Israel forever. That's the theological foundation for what's going on here. And even if there are sins in Solomon's heart as he does what we'll see him do in this chapter, that theological reality remains what the Lord's going to accomplish, even with pure or impure motives on the part of the human actors.
Yeah, and I think there's one more thing to add to that. From a worldly perspective, even if Solomon is not pure of heart at all times, which we're definitely not saying that he is. I mean, all the kings have things to confess, some more than others. But there's a nation to protect, right? And there's a nation to rule. I mean, the alternative is chaos, right? Where everybody does right what's right in their own eyes. And we've already seen how that works, through the book of Judges. And so there's definitely in the interest of peace and security, Solomon really needs to make sure that his throne is properly established. That's actually for the good of the people in the end. But your point, though, about the promise of a Davidic king on the throne, that's, of course, primary.
Yeah. All right. So let's go ahead and see what happens here. David has just died. Solomon is now fully king. He's the only one. But Adonijah, the previous rival to the throne, he's still around and he makes a move. So we're picking up 1 Kings 2, beginning at verse 13. Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, came to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon. And she said, "Do you come peacefully?" He said, "Peacefully." Then he said, "I have something to say to you." She said, "Speak." He said, "You know that the kingdom was mine and that all Israel fully expected me to reign. However, the kingdom has turned about and become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord. And now I have one request to make of you. Do not refuse me." She said to him, "Speak." And he said, "Please ask King Solomon, he will not refuse you, to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife." Bathsheba said, "Very well, I will speak for you to the king." So Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak to him on behalf of Adonijah. And the king rose to meet her and bowed down to her. Then he sat on his throne and had a seat brought for the king's mother, and she sat on his right. Then she said, "I have one small request to make of you. Do not refuse me." And the king said to her, "Make your request, my mother, for I will not refuse you." She said, "Let Abishag the Shunammite be given to Adonijah your brother as his wife." King Solomon answered his mother, "And why do you ask Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him the kingdom also, for he is my older brother, and on his side are Abiathar the priest, and Joab, the son of Zeruiah." Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, saying, "God do so to me, and more also, if this word does not cost Adonijah his life. Now therefore, as the Lord lives, who has established me and placed me on the throne of David my father, and who has made me a house, as he promised, Adonijah shall be put to death today." So King Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he struck him down, and he died. All right, we'll pause there at verse 25.
Sounds good.
So, yeah. All right. So the first incident goes between Adonijah and Solomon, but Bathsheba is put in the middle by Adonijah. Talk to us about why Adonijah makes the move that he does in going to Bathsheba.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, he's not going to make the appeal directly to Solomon because, and at first, well, I don't even know what part of this to parse first. Let's actually talk about Abishag just for a second before
sure.
we go back,
yeah,
we'll
remind
go back
us who
to Bathsheba.
That, yeah, remind us who she is.
If you remember, Abishag is the young woman who was basically given to David, not as a wife. And so that is significant because there seems to be a little bit of squishiness in all that, right? But she's given to David in his old age, basically to help him stay warm. And the text specifically says they did not know each other in the biblical sense, of course. And so they're not, she's not a concubine. She is not a wife, but she is intimate in that way with David. And, and so what is implied when Adonijah asks for it, I think Solomon's response seems perfectly reasonable. This is his way, his kind of backdoor way of making a play for the throne. Now, so why ask Bathsheba? Well, Bathsheba's, of course, I mean, who who isn't, you know, more kindly disposed towards your mother, right? I mean, you know, it's classic triangulation. And you know, and we've seen already, and we'll see later on, that Bathsheba has a favored place in Solomon's own, you know, in his own throne room. You know, she gets to sit at his right hand. I mean, that tells you, you know, just the fact that she sits right there in a chair at his throne, you know, tells you something about his respect and inclination for his own mother, right? And so he's trying to play the angles. I mean, this is clearly a political move, and he's trying to do the best that he can. I think one of the nagging questions I have, and I'm happy to hear your thoughts on this too, how much of this does Bathsheba really understand? Like, how innocent is she in all this? Because, you know, she says, okay, go ahead, make the request. And she doesn't stop it. She does carry it forward to Solomon. You know, I'm of the opinion that I don't think she's quite put it together. I mean, I think she almost assumes too well of Adonijah. But here's the thing. He's already tipped his hat. Back in verse 15, he even says, hey, the kingdom was practically mine, right? And all Israel, right? You know, you can kind of get the sense of all the hyperbole here. All of Israel expected me to reign, right? Everybody was expecting this, you know, but, you know, then my brother came in and snatched it out from underneath me, right? Because now he says it was his from the Lord. How much does he really believe that? He knows that's the right thing to say. So I think there's some questions in all of this, and I'm happy to be instructed about it. But I find myself scratching my head a little bit about how much does Bathsheba know, and how honest is this statement that it was from the Lord, right? We know that's true. And is this a bit of irony that he says that, even though he clearly doesn't mean it? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, so, okay, there's a couple of things going on. I think you're right about Adonijah, that he's making a play for the throne. And I think Solomon's reaction to it, in addition to Adonijah's own words, show that. I would read what he says, especially at the end of verse 15, well, maybe all of 15, as trying to butter up Bathsheba a little bit and try to pull the wool over her eyes. Right. I mean, did, like, the kingdom was mine? Sort of. I mean, he had a pretty good following back in chapter 1. He was basically throwing a party there in Jerusalem when he heard the trumpet sound and realized Solomon had been proclaimed king. So maybe there's some accuracy to that. But, you know, yeah, now it's from the Lord. He's willing to concede that for the sake of trying something. I think that's the way Adonijah's asking here. And two, just before I go into Bathsheba, when you were saying about why Abishag and what this signifies, if you think back to 2 Samuel and the action that Absalom was advised to take when he was usurping the throne, where he slept with the 10 concubines of David, that was a clear claim to the throne.
Right.
This is right next to it in terms of what's going on. And right. Surely Solomon, you know, remembers what happened with his brother Absalom in that regard. Yeah. And I think that helps to explain his reaction. To Bathsheba, though, I don't know. I think on the one hand, she comes off a little naive here. But then you kind of wonder, if you go back to chapter 1 and the way that Nathan approached her as well, mm-hmm. and used or made use of her role there with David as a favored wife to make sure the throne was secured for Solomon. Maybe Bathsheba knows more than she is letting on, and she's like, okay, Adonijah, if you want to dig your own grave, I'll be glad to do it. You know, maybe she really is the wise mother, and she's the one that's kind of playing along, like, oh, Solomon, how could you do that? Well, maybe that's not the reaction she's having. You know, maybe she recognizes. Maybe I don't think there's any way to tell this from the text. But maybe she sees a threat and wants Solomon to deal with it. That's pure speculation on my part,
though. Right, right. I've thought about that too. Maybe because you'd think that being in the king's household for so long, I mean, not just Israel, but I mean, you start to read the historical accounts of so many of these ancient kings, or even for that matter, modern rulers. I mean, there's always intrigue and there's plots and plots and plots. And you just got to wonder, she can't be that naive, right? And so maybe she is just, she's just being the messenger and she's going to just step back and watch it all unfold. I mean, because remember, she's the one who reminds David that he had promised to Solomon that he would be the king, right? And so it's not like she does clearly have a dog in this fight. And so, yeah, I'm probably with you that she's playing perhaps naive, but I'm not, I just have a hard time believing that she is. But in the end, I'm not sure it makes that big of a difference, but it's a fascinating kind of like character study.
Yeah, it really is. One of the things that is kind of hard to, or makes this difficult to ascertain, is even in both of these sections that we've read so far, the interaction between Adonijah and Bathsheba, and then Bathsheba and Solomon, you have this almost, you get a feel for the court realities. You know, like it's almost a very formal way of back right. and forth. Do you come peacefully? Peacefully. You know, I mean, it's just back and forth, even between Solomon and his own mother. And that, at least as I read it, makes it difficult to ascertain the tone in which these things were spoken. But I mean, she asks, like, do you come peacefully? Which would seem to be a recognition that there is some danger here. The fact that he's still around, that Solomon chose to spare his life previously, he could still pose some danger here. I don't know. It's hard to say from the text. Maybe she is naive. Maybe she doesn't know. Maybe she's playing the side and getting Solomon to act, to do something that he perhaps should have already done.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Well, you know, while we're on the whole topic of speculation, right? You guys are never going to ask me back after this. So, right, Jesus identifies himself as one who is greater than Solomon, right?
Yeah.
Which naturally always makes me think about, like, well, what's the relationship between like Mary and Bathsheba then?
So I this has been going through my head
too. Have you thought about this too?
Well, because it is, you know, like the mother of Solomon. Yeah. Yeah. But I'm not sure what, if there's any theology to make of this, but you're right. So you've got the mother of Solomon who comes with a request. And that happens at least once in the Gospels, in John chapter 2.
Exactly, the wedding of Cana. Okay.
So I'm curious what you've been thinking about, because I'm not sure what to do with the parallel.
Right. I mean, so I'm not sure either, but it does strike me that he, you know, he doesn't, if I'm remembering correctly, never mind. The same idiom is used between Elisha and the widow, you know, what to me and to you, Jesus says the same thing in Wedding Cana. Never mind. Sorry, I'm just remembering something different.
Okay.
But when he comes, you know, there is this kind of, you know, acknowledgement of their authority, right? There's this deference to their sons and, you know, and also the decisions that they're actually going to make. And so now, it's not exactly parallel, but
there's probably similarities. Yeah.
Somebody smarter than both of us could probably make something of this, or maybe there's nothing there at all, but it really does get me to thinking that, like, is Jesus truly greater than Solomon, even in this regard that he treats his mother perhaps even better than Solomon treats her? I don't know.
Well, so, okay, maybe here's a parallel that Solomon, in the way that he responds to this request, acts in true wisdom, justice, and righteousness, apart from, and again, without any speculation as to what Bathsheba is or isn't thinking, Solomon acts in response to this request with that wisdom, righteousness, and justice, and doesn't get wrapped up in any other emotion that could sway him to make a bad decision.
Right.
I think then in comparison, if you look at John chapter 2, where Mary comes to Jesus and says, hey, there's no more wine. And Jesus too responds, it almost sounds cold at first. You know, what is this? The phrase that you were remembering, what is this between me and you? My hour has not yet come. Jesus in that time is also focused on what his role is as the Christ and acts with that in mind rather than any sort of personal motives. Maybe that's the right way to say this. Solomon, I think, does that here in a smaller way. Jesus does that in a fuller way in the gospel. Maybe that's a parallel.
Right. That's actually maybe not a bad point. Even if this isn't the exact parallel to get it from, we definitely recognize that both of these realities are happening, that they're not acting out of their own naked self-interest. But you notice ultimately what Solomon is doing is protecting the throne that is given to him from God. You know, he's protecting a divine institution. And if we go along with, you know, especially in the early church, so much of the interpretations around the wedding at Cana, of course, is the king's wedding banquet, right? And as we see all of this unfolding, there's a, you might say, a regal dimension to the wedding at Cana and a lot of the things that follow, where Jesus is, you might say, how would I put this? Not protecting, but acting in accordance with his rightful place as the king of Israel, right? And so, I mean, perhaps in that way, you know, both Solomon is king and Jesus is king, you know, these interactions with their own mothers are still redirecting them to what their essential identity is, and that is the Lord's anointed one, right? Yeah, so maybe that's it.
Well, yeah. So in both of those texts, and maybe we can stick with this one just to kind of work our way through it, especially in this text, there's a greater reality that's at play than what Solomon and his mother, you know, have as their relationship. The greater reality that goes even beyond the earthly family is the family of God. And right. And Solomon acts with that in mind. So from that and other things in the text, I guess make that case more fully as to how Solomon, as he acts in this section of the text, and I think it carries forward from here, is acting not with personal vengeance, but with that thought of the right. kingdom of God in mind.
No, this is exactly where I was going next, so well teed up. It all really comes down, I think, to verse 24. Let me reread it. Now, therefore, so this is Solomon speaking. Now, as the Lord lives, who has established me and placed me on the throne of my father David, and who has made me a house as he promised, Adonijah shall be put to death this day. And so you notice all of this, Solomon is the recipient of God's actions. The Lord's the one who placed him on the throne. It's David's throne. And so once again, making that connection back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, and you know, he's made me a house. It's part of this dynasty as he promised. And so Solomon makes this direct line that this is not merely a matter of, you know, he's threatening my own personal quest for power, but Adonijah is trying to undermine the very will and actions of God. And so, of course, he shall be put to death. Why? Because he's acting against the Lord's anointed one. It's the Lord's anointed one. That's the key part of it. And so then, you know, he has him struck down. Yeah.
Yeah. So, with the way Solomon speaks in verse 24, invoking the Lord's name, I think it does go to show that, well, Adonijah, even if he was using the right words back in verse 15, he did not believe them.
Yeah.
If the kingdom really was Solomon's from the Lord's, then Adonijah's request is entirely out of place. Solomon recognizes it for what it is and does something about it. He puts Adonijah to death, which again is striking. He didn't do this before. I mean, that's maybe another just thing to grapple with briefly here before the break, is the fact that he doesn't there's no life in prison for Adonijah. It's right. The death penalty now.
Yeah, no, that's really well put. The fact that he kills him now rather than previously indicates a level of mercy on Solomon's part. It's only when Adonijah continues to threaten the Lord's, you know, the Lord's actual action and promise in making Solomon the king, that's when he has to die. And we're going to see that theme actually kind of replayed with several of these characters, both not Abiathar and also even Shimei as well.
Yeah. What strikes me, the last thing just before we take our break, then the thing that strikes me here is how difficult this transition of power is when everyone should know from the prophet Nathan, who has spoken the word of the Lord, in addition to what David has clearly said, everyone should know who's next in line. It's just remarkable how difficult this transition of power is when they've got a clear word from God. But I suppose there's nothing.
You assume
new.
They were all listening.
That's right. That's right. The same is true for us. We have clear words from God, and we don't always keep things as simple as we should in listening.
But I don't like his word, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so Adonijah here, I mean, he was warned previously by Solomon, show yourself a worthy man, be faithful to the king, ultimately the Lord and his king. And Adonijah has not done that. And so he receives the penalty that Solomon said he would before in chapter one. So we've heard already a couple of other people who have been conspirators with Adonijah, and they come up in the rest of the text, which we will pick up on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Jeremiah Johnson this morning about 1 Kings chapter 2. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Who does Lutheran Church Extension Fund serve, you ask? It's simple. We serve Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries and church workers with loans and ministry services. And it's faithful Lutherans like you, church members and church workers alike, investing with LCEF that makes it possible for LCEF to serve these ministries. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCF investments are not FDIC insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Monday, May 5th. We're studying 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 13 to 46 with Pastor Jeremiah Johnson. He serves at Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota. Pastor Johnson, before we move on in the text, any final comments about what happens with Adonijah and the part we've already looked at?
Right. Before the break, I forgot to draw us back to the very end of chapter 1. We should really remember that Solomon gave Adonijah an opportunity to live, and you know, Adonijah ran to the altar, held on the horns, and he said, basically, promise me that you won't kill me. And Solomon says, hey, if you're a worthy man, then none of the hairs on your head will die. But if he proves himself wicked, then he's going to die. And so, I mean, it's already been the sort of the terms of the deal have already been laid out for him. And we shouldn't forget that Adonijah has already paid homage to King Solomon, at least outwardly acknowledging that Solomon is indeed the king. And so when he makes this play for the throne, asking for Abishag, he's basically going back on his word. And Solomon is simply making good on his word that he'd already given him.
That's right. Now, when Solomon told Bathsheba what was going on, he also mentioned both Abiathar and Joab as being on the side of Adonijah. Those are the next two people that come up in the text. First, Abiathar the priest, then Joab, the son of Zeruiah. So we're reading again here in 1 Kings 2, beginning now at verse 26. And to Abiathar the priest, the king said, go to Anathoth, to your estate, for you deserve death. But I will not at this time put you to death, because you carried the ark of the Lord God, before David my father, and because you shared in all my father's affliction. So Solomon expelled Abiathar from being priest to the Lord, thus fulfilling the word of the Lord that he had spoken concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh. When the news came to Joab, for Joab had supported Adonijah, although he had not supported Absalom, Joab fled to the tent of the Lord and caught hold of the horns of the altar. And when it was told King Solomon, Joab has fled to the tent of the Lord, and behold, he is beside the altar, Solomon sent Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, saying, go strike him down. So Benaiah came to the tent of the Lord and said to him, the king commands, come out. But he said, no, I will die here. Then Benaiah brought the king word again, saying, thus said Joab, and thus he answered me. The king replied to him, do as he has said, strike him down and bury him, and thus take away from me and from my father's house the guilt for the blood that Joab shed without cause. The Lord will bring back his bloody deeds on his own head, because, without the knowledge of my father David, he attacked and killed with the sword two men more righteous and better than himself. Abner, the son of Ner, commander of the army of Israel, and Amasa, the son of Jether, commander of the army of Judah. So shall their blood come back on the head of Joab and on the head of his descendants forever. But for David and for his descendants and for his house and for his throne, there shall be peace from the Lord forevermore. Then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, went up and struck him down and put him to death. And he was buried in his own house in the wilderness. The king put Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, over the army in place of Joab. And the king put Zadok the priest in place of Abiathar. I will pause there at verse 35 to talk about these two co-conspirators of Abiathar. Abiathar's place in this text is rather brief in terms of the mm-hmm. space, but there's a lot of history there. Remind us just who is Abiathar? Going back even to the days of David, some of the context that does come up here as Solomon addresses him.
Right. Abiathar is, and I should have looked all this stuff up better. So I'm going from the shooting from the hip here. You may have to help me, but if I remember correctly, he is actually a descendant of the house of Eli. And remember, the Eli was promised like the, you know, you will no longer serve as priest, and of course his own sons die, and kind of one after another. I think this is the very last loose end that this descendant of Eli finally also gets stripped of his authority as well. Obviously, most recently, Abiathar, you know, sided with, you know, with Adonijah in order to proclaim him king, because you got to have some of the priests in, you got to have some of the priests, you know, authorizing the entire thing. Yeah, so what else am I missing?
Well,
remind
the other thing that I think is perhaps worth remembering is Abiathar has been with David for quite some time.
Right.
Solomon acknowledges that when it comes to the afflictions that he shared. And that goes all the way back to 1 Samuel chapter 22, when Saul slaughtered the priests who had aided David while he was escaping from Saul. And Abiathar was the only one that escaped from that slaughter at Nob. And that's in 1 Samuel chapter 22.
Right.
So I think Solomon here, he realizes the history that David has with Abiathar. And I think in the way that he treats Abiathar and the mercy that he shows him by not taking his life, that comes through. In addition to the fact that he's a priest,
right?
What Saul didn't recognize way back in 1 Samuel chapter 22, Solomon does.
That's right. Yeah, I think what's really also an interesting little tidbit, even though just in these short two verses, he makes reference to his contact with the Ark of God. Solomon even confirms that, you know, this action should have been, it warranted putting him to death. And so it's clearly all framed as mercy because he's not getting what he deserves. But, you know, it's almost as if his relationship to the Ark of God and his service becomes almost an act of atonement. It specifically says, but I will not at this time put you to death because you carried the Ark of the Lord God before my father, because you shared in all my father's affliction. And so it's his proper service effectively, and, you know, his relationship to the Lord. And I mean, maybe it's not an exact application of it, but perhaps you might say more devotionally, that, you know, you touch the holy things of God and you can't be lightly cast aside, right? I mean, in some ways, that's kind of that's a great encouragement to us, right? Because, you know, especially we're always reminded during the season of Lent, like, from dust you are and to dust you shall return. Just like Abiathar, we deserve to be put to death. That's the cold, hard reality of it. But the Lord has touched us with his holy things, right? This is in some ways very much the same example with Isaiah, right? He's going to die when he goes into the temple, but the angel, you know, touches him with the coals from the incense altar. Your guilt has been taken away. It's, you know, being touched by holy things is what preserves our lives. I mean, in a way, that's how we could describe the entire Christian life. Being touched with his holy name and holy baptism, being fed his own body and blood in the Lord's Supper, you know, the being touched in our ears with his own holy word. These are the things that keep us from the death that we deserve. I mean, you know, this is why we call them, you know, the holy sacrament, holy absolution, holy, you know, holy baptism, because these holy things that touch us are what keep us alive. What else can I say?
Yeah. So Abiathar receives mercy. He is told to go home, and presumably he does go and stay there, although he is no longer a priest in fulfillment of the Lord's word, taking us once again all the way back to the very beginning of 1 Samuel. Yeah. What the Lord has spoken does come to pass. That sets the stage for the greater priesthood that will come through the Son of David, Jesus. All of those, you know, just dots along the way that we need to keep connecting as this story leads us forward to him. So Abiathar is not going to be the priest anymore. He is replaced by Zadok, as we heard at the end of that section of verse 35. There's a much greater amount of text that's spent concerning Joab. So Joab, he actually hears about what has happened to Adonijah and perhaps what has happened to Abiathar as well. And he's a little more proactive, and he tries to run away.
Right.
Goes to the horns of the altar. Take us into what happens with Joab.
I think even before we get there,
or give us the history of him first.
Yeah, we do really well to do a little bit of a review of history, because there's a lot about Joab that we hear. And he's a complicated guy, because on the one hand, he is David's faithful commander. You know, he's first introduced in 2 Samuel at the Battle of Gibeon, which is kind of the key battle that where, if you remember, David, when he takes the throne at first, he's only the king of Judah, not the king of all of Israel, not all 12 tribes. And so there's this ongoing battle between Saul's commander, Abner, and Joab, David's commander. Now, he's apparently a very effective commander, but not always a super nice guy.
Sometimes those things go hand in hand.
Yeah, well, you know. So there's a number of these episodes. Let me run them off for you, just because I think it gives you a more full picture of how complex of a character this is. So Abner, that's Saul's commander, kills Joab's brother, and Joab seeks vengeance upon him. And it stayed for a little bit until the very next chapter in 2 Samuel chapter 3. And even though, and this is really key, David had implicitly pardoned him. David had let him live, but Joab just basically entirely ignores that and kills Abner anyway. Remember, of course, this is not Abner, David's son. This is Abner, Saul's commander. Don't get confused between the two. But the two that are actually specifically made reference to in here, let's see, where is that? He makes reference to two of the people whom he kills.
It's which verse is that?
32. Yeah,
he killed two men more righteous than himself.
Right. He first of all, that first one I just made reference to, Abner the son of Ner, the commander of the army of Israel. But then there's Amasa, the son of Jether. And so this is quite a bit later on. There was a guy named Sheba, and he basically said, "Hey, David's a putz. Everybody, there's no king in Israel anymore. Everybody just do your own thing." I mean, that's essentially what he did. He rejects the rule of David. And so then David sends Amasa to go and basically muster all the troops. And Amasa actually, he delays. And just because he apparently had this delay, and whether or not it was really a legitimate delay, that's up for debate. But the point is that this is not something that should have warranted the death penalty, but Joab apparently gets real impatient with him because he doesn't do his job real fast, and he kills Amasa. And it's, once again, this is not by David's authority. And in fact, it probably is in direct contradiction to David's request, because David was one who sent Amasa to go and muster the troops. You know, and then there's also the entire problem with Absalom as well. If you remember that David specifically says, "Hey, when you find my son Absalom, be nice to him." And the folks who first find him are, but Joab goes and sticks three spears right into Absalom. And David doesn't forget that. So he's loyal on the one hand to David, but on the other hand, he's kind of rogue and incredibly ruthless. And so, I mean, just to put it really simply, Joab's kind of got it coming, and David apparently either, you know, out of mercy or out of expediency, never sees fit to sort of take care of Joab. But he tells Solomon that he really needs to take care of Joab. And I think there's probably two issues here. You know, there's simply the matter of justice that David hasn't done that needs to be resolved. But, you know, Joab is also, you know, he sided with Adonijah. And so he was a threat to Solomon as well. And so I don't think those are two mutually exclusive concerns.
Yeah. I the whole history of Joab, I think, is instructive in this regard, precisely because Solomon doesn't bring all of the history up. And we noted this in the previous text when David had given these instructions to Solomon before David died, that the fact that he doesn't bring up, say, Absalom particularly, which was a very personal matter for David, reminds us that this is not personal vengeance. Right? This is about the shedding of innocent blood, which is very much a theme in the way that Solomon speaks concerning what's to happen to Joab. There is this innocent blood, this blood that's been shed. It's currently on the house of David, and it doesn't belong there. It needs to be back on the head of Joab because he's the one that shed it. And so I think that history of Joab is very helpful in keeping in mind that Solomon is not exacting personal vengeance here or some kind of, you know, it's a preemptive strike, it seems, perhaps. Right. But he has been warned by David, and Joab is guilty, and it's only been mercy that has spared him so far.
And perhaps one very simple thing we should all be reminded of is that the kings are the final judges in ancient Israel. I think sometimes we forget this point, being in a country with divided branches of government, where the president doesn't have the authority that the Supreme Court does, but back in the ancient world, specifically with Israel, the king is the Supreme Court. And so these decisions that he's making, and I think you're quite right, these are not matters of personal vengeance. These are his to make as the king. In fact, not just are they under his authority, they are his responsibility to do so. And I think when we see it from that angle, this doesn't seem so much of a cruel action, but this is him essentially setting wrongs right. And that's such a good observation that you made. Let me at least repeat it, that there were other, and it wasn't even just Absalom, there were other personal vendettas that Solomon could have raised against Joab. But he specifically cites these two individuals that don't have direct personal connection to him. And that's very telling.
One of the details when it comes to Joab, which is more at the beginning of the text before Solomon gives all these history lessons to us, is that Joab goes to the tent of the Lord and he grabs the horns of the altar. Mm-hmm. That was the place where, in the previous chapter, Adonijah found refuge. Here, it does not end up being a place of refuge for Joab. And he even says, just go ahead and kill me here. Maybe that's perhaps an odd thing to see.
Right.
That even there at the altar of the Lord, that's where Joab is put to death. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it seems supremely ironic, doesn't it? At the very place where sins could be atoned for, his own blood will be demanded of him. But I think a bit of the paradox, though, that there's so much we don't know about this. I mean, has he actually repented of any of these things? We have no indication that he shows any remorse over them, but at the same time, we don't know all the details. But I think in many ways, it emphasizes the very necessity of the altar which he pleads. But at the same time, it's not an automatic or a guarantee. Like, just being in the house of the Lord doesn't somehow, it almost reminds me a little bit of Saul. Now I'm reading between the lines, and so you can call me on that if you want. But if you remember with the battles with the Philistines, he brings the Ark of the Covenant as almost like this lucky rabbit's foot. And then he decides to, okay, well, we need to offer a sacrifice, right? Because, so that we make sure that God's going to be on our side. This is clearly a misuse of the entire sacrificial system. And maybe that's what's being sort of implied in all of this, is that yes, the tabernacle is there, the altar is there in order to atone for the sins of the people, but it doesn't become this sort of automatic, talisman that just because you hold on to the altar doesn't mean that you automatically get forgiven. It almost reminds me a little bit of when Jesus tells the religious leaders, not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of God, that there can be actions which are sort of empty of, or not at least in concert with the way that the Lord chooses to give out his mercy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think what you said earlier about going back to chapter one, that Adonijah has been warned.
Right.
And he, when he fled to the altar and grabbed onto the horns, I think you could probably make the case that perhaps at that point, his sin, his rebellion against Solomon is not fully intentional. There may be some ignorance there. And when you look in, this is in Exodus chapter 21, where it describes someone who unintentionally kills another man and receives refuge, and that person can grab onto the place that the Lord says and will receive mercy. But Exodus 21 verse 14 says this, "But if a man willfully attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from my altar that he may die." And that very much describes Joab, not only in the history with Abner and Amasa, but at this very moment where the conspiracy against Solomon has been knowingly renewed, both Adonijah and Joab receive what the Lord said. And it, again, even though he has fled to the altar, his intentional repeated sins receive the judgment that the Lord speaks. The only other thing that I noted in this text is with this matter of blood guilt, that Solomon is pretty forthright that the blood needs to no longer be on the house of David. It needs to be upon the head of Joab. There will come a son of David who will receive all the blood guilt of humanity going forward.
I'm glad you pointed that out, because it wasn't until we really started this conversation that I'm starting to see that, isn't it interesting that the judicial function of the kingship has so much interaction with the, you might say, the atoning and sacrificial nature of the, you know, of certainly the tabernacle, but I would say more broadly with their entire, what we would usually call the cultic system. I don't mean that it's a cult, but like all of the rules and regulations about how sin is to be atoned for, how blood guilt is to be removed. And even, I hadn't thought about this until just now, we're going to get with Shimei effectively like an instance of a city of refuge, which is once again, another way of dealing with these. And so what we have juxtaposed here is throughout all of this chapter is essentially what happens when you get judged and how might you be spared from it? I think those are the questions that are the common denominators throughout all of these accounts. Even with this very next one, we're going to see, I think, that in spades.
All right, let's keep reading. This is now 1 Kings chapter 2, beginning at verse 36. "Then the king sent and summoned Shimei and said to him, 'Build yourself a house in Jerusalem and dwell there, and do not go out from there to any place whatever. For on the day you go out and cross the brook Kidron, know for certain that you shall die. Your blood shall be on your own head.' And Shimei said to the king, 'What you say is good. As my lord the king has said, so will your servant do.' So Shimei lived in Jerusalem many days. But it happened at the end of 3 years that two of Shimei's servants ran away to Achish, the son of Maacah, king of Gath. And when it was told Shimei, 'Behold, your servants are in Gath,' Shimei arose and saddled a donkey and went to Gath to Achish to seek his servants. Shimei went and brought his servants from Gath. And when Solomon was told that Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath and returned, the king sent and summoned Shimei and said to him, 'Did I not make you swear by the Lord and solemnly warn you, saying, know for certain that on the day you go out and go to any place whatever, you shall die? And you said to me, what you say is good, I will obey. Why then have you not kept your oath to the Lord and the commandment with which I commanded you?' The king also said to Shimei, 'You know in your own heart all the harm that you did to David my father. So the Lord will bring back your harm on your own head. But King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever.' Then the king commanded Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he went out and struck him down, and he died. So the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon." And that takes us to the end of 1 Kings chapter 2. So I got about 4 minutes here to talk about Shimei, what happens to him, this matter of justice, again, as you were talking about. Take us into the section.
Right. I think I may have mentioned before, but Shimei was the one, of course, who had cursed David, and of course, cursed him as the Lord's anointed one. But I mean, Solomon seems gracious here, you know, giving him, you know, he doesn't give him, you know, sort of a free ride. He doesn't pardon him fully, but he basically says, hey, you can stay, you could live in Jerusalem, and as long as you don't leave, then you're in good shape. Now, there may have been, we might hypothesize some political motivations for this. He kind of keep his eye on him. It seems to be sensible, right? And it's kind of like saying, hey, you can play, telling your kids, you can play right there in the living room for the time being, right? But it really reminded me, I think it's very similar to, it's almost as if Jerusalem becomes a city of refuge for Shimei. If you remember, there were certain cities in Israel that were designated as cities of refuge, that if you committed a crime and unintentionally that you could flee to these places and that you couldn't be killed there for it. So it was a matter of protection against unintentional sin. And this was even an intentional sin, but it's almost become like Jerusalem becomes that. But, you know, time goes on and he gets two servants who run away, and apparently their worth seems to be of more value to him than they, although the text may imply that he's trying to get out of Jerusalem and no one notices. I'm not positive, but it does say he arose, which might even imply at night, and he saddled a donkey. Well, he's got servants, right? You don't normally saddle your own donkey if you're the head of this. You know, if you're the head of the household, you get your servants to do it. And so I kind of wonder if he's not trying to just sneak off and do it. But, you know, Solomon catches wind of this. Apparently, he's got pretty good intel. So, yep. But I mean, in the end, what does Solomon do? He does exactly what he's promised. He says, if you stay there, you live. If you leave, you die. And so Solomon is good to his word. But notice there at the end that he points out that, number one, it is the oath to the Lord. It's not just that he broken an oath to Solomon. He's broken an oath to God himself, right? And he reminds Shimei of his sins. He says, you know, in your own heart, all the harm that you did to David, my father, and the Lord will bring back your harm on your own head. Once again, it's not as if this is, you know, so much this is retribution from Solomon. He's basically saying, listen, you made your own bed. Now you're going to lay in it. This is the sin which you've done. And now it's coming back to you as well. But King Solomon will be blessed, and the throne of David will be established before the Lord forever. You kind of wonder why he says that. And here's my theory on it. It's almost more to remind us or his hearers that Shimei may have tried to undermine the throne of David and therefore also the throne of Solomon, but God's going to have his way. He will not be undone. He will not be thwarted. The kingship will indeed remain with him. And sadly, though, when he chooses to reject the king, the son of David, the sin lays upon his own head. I mean, that's basically exactly what all of those who reject Jesus find out as well. When they reject the son of David, what are they left with? But the sin remains on their own head.
Yep. So take that, make it a positive example then. Stay in the city of refuge. Stay right where the son of David has put you. There your sin is covered, and there you have life and forgiveness, thinking forward to the son of David, Jesus Christ.
Right.
Pastor Jeremiah Johnson serves at Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota. He's been helping us today to study 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 13 to 46. Pastor Johnson, thanks for being our guest today.
Hey, thank you.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about 1 Kings 2, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we read 1 Kings chapter 3, a pivotal chapter in Solomon's reign, as the Lord invites him to pray and Solomon asks for wisdom. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.